Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your favorite weekly libertarian podcast brought to you by the magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hi, everyone.
Did you forget who we were for a second? Were you like, who are these people?
Yeah, come on, Matt.
I'm running a little late today, so like certain things aren't working in the way that
I was hoping that we could string it out long enough where Peter would not be able to say that.
Why? Why don't you want a happy Monday? Do you hate Mondays?
No, I want a blue Monday. I want to shoot the whole day down. For God's sake, like there's a long lineage of things about Monday being not so good.
We're going to talk about something that's not a mass murder in San Diego, but rather a mass capture of documents in Mar-a-Lago here in a moment. But first, Andrew Heaton is advertising on this podcast.
What? Do we realize I love that. This?
Ladies and gentlemen, senoras y señoras, you know him from those hilarious Reason TV videos with the brothers Bragg, including but not limited to the Citizens versus Government series and the libertarian versions of various classic movies and television shows. Hell, you know Andrew Heaton from this very podcast, which he used to host. Well, Andrew Bloody Heaton hosts another podcast that you all should listen to called The Political Orphanage. And you should go over there and mash the subscribe button right now. The Political Orphanage is designed for people tired of seeing the world through the lens of red versus blue and who still maintain friendships with people they disagree with. It is just as you would suspect, smart, funny, and wonky. Lots of interesting guests, such as Justin Amash, Andrew Yang, various authors and comedians. You will like it. There's no way that you won't. Go listen to The Political Orphanage right now. You'll be very glad you did. Okay. Speaking of red versus blue, or maybe blue versus red, Nick, I know it feels like it's been a year already, but it was really only 1 week ago after we'd wrapped up the Reason Roundtable podcast of last Monday, since the FBI showed up at Mar-a-Lago with a search warrant and carted off 11 sets of classified documents, which were living at Donald Trump's Florida resort in suspected violation of three federal statutes, which are gathering, transmitting, or losing defense information, destruction, alteration, or falsification of records in federal investigations, and concealment, removal, or mutilation of government records. This is, to put it mildly, unprecedented, raising all kinds of procedural questions, and also raising the political temperature in a country that's been on simmer for at least 7 years now. On Thursday, an armed Trump supporter wearing body armor tried to breach an FBI office in Columbus, Ohio, and ended up being shot and killed after a standoff with police. Another man drove into the Capitol building barrier over the weekend, fired a gun into the air, then killed himself. It's unclear whether that was a political act. And there were armed MAGA protesters outside the FBI office in Phoenix last week because Phoenix. Just before the search warrant was unsealed last week, Trump reportedly sent Attorney General Merrick Garland a cryptic message saying, "The country is on fire. What can I do to reduce the heat?" Catherine, since we're always striving here at Reason to not reduce the heat, but at least add some light, tell us what you, chief libertarian editor person, make of these remarkable events? And do we know enough to assess whether the search and seizure was justified?
Yeah, I mean, I've been on the same roller coaster, I think, that many have this last week. First and foremost, the conservatives discover maybe the FBI is a little heavy-handed or high-horsed or whichever thing you want to use in your Welshian metaphor. You know, the totally fair charges of hypocrisy in every single direction, you know, but her emails. You know, are we abolishing the FBI now? Are we defunding the police? What are we doing? So, I do think there has been, once again, thanks, Donald Trump, some interesting scrambling of some of people's priors, especially about law enforcement going into this. That said, the unsealing of the warrant was, I think, like a very laudatory act here. And the fact that that was done quickly and, as far as I can tell, procedurally correctly, was really valuable because it allowed people to have information instead of just screaming into the Twitter void about what was going on. And I am not an expert in document classification, but it sure does seem like that stuff was legitimate. Like it shouldn't have been just like hanging around in somebody's retirement home back room with a padlock on the door. We're going to talk a lot more about all the ins and outs of this, but I will say my other big takeaway is it's astonishing to me that all this stuff still exists on paper. Like, I don't have any paper. I haven't had paper for years.
Wait, don't you edit a print magazine?
But I don't keep a copy as my records. Like, the records are online. The, you know, manuscripts are online. And, you know, I understand why in some ways paper may still be one of the more secure ways to disseminate information that shouldn't get copied and shared around, or that you might worry about it being stolen. But if the result is that then people fill up boxes with paper and cart them out of the White House and some of that paper contains important secrets, maybe it's time to rethink paper.
Well, Trump also doesn't use email, famously. He didn't have a smartphone, and I don't believe he had a laptop.
As far as I understand, though.
Maybe he had a smartphone, though, but like didn't use email or text. It didn't use email on it in the way that most people do.
As far as I understand, though, the fact that stuff was on paper wasn't bowing to Trump's quirks. I think that's how that information is disseminated to presidents, right?
I believe that is the case often, though I don't know President Obama. Was much more online for a president and like famously stayed up at night reading Josh Barrow on his iPad.
Oh, he had cabinet meetings in Grand Theft Auto.
In Meta. He would have them in Meta.
He was the only one who had Meta. He had an iPod that was strategically loaded with music appealing to every demographic group, including unborn children.
It was a big deal, though, with Obama.
It was
they had
a different
to,
America.
I believe it was the Secret Service, maybe one of the other intelligence agencies, actually had to like jury-rig his iPhone so that it was usable by a president.
Let's assume for the moment.
Can we talk about the Richard Spencer haircut that you seem to have?
Yes. Okay. Let's assume for a moment that Trump is in violation of those three statutes, which Hillary Clinton was in violation of the statute that she was not prosecuted for, famously by James Comey when he explained all that stuff. If Trump is not charged with any of those crimes, is this justifiable?
I don't know. For me, the big thing, and I want to recommend people to Jacob Sullum's article at Reason.com about this, about, you know, there is every indication from what we know now that Trump's issues here are much more significant or more serious than Hillary's, which were serious about her kind of abrogating various kinds of security laws and whatnot. We got to find that out. And I think, you know, there's also a long history of this kind of stuff, these kinds of rules being broken without prosecution. So it's very hard to know. And for me, what this foregrounds, and I know that I am not only a broken record, but that nobody listening to this podcast remembers what records are other than, you know, kind of fetish items for people like Peter Suderman, where you have, you know, a 3-foot thick vinyl record that you don't play or you play once a year. But, you know what
that
this
makes
highlights?
It sound better, Nick.
Yeah, I know. It's more human when you can hear the hiss in the background. I lived through those debates and no longer care because I listened to everything through the shittiest, cheapest, you know, earbuds that I can find. So it could be caviar going in, and it's not, you know, I don't know what it is coming out. In any case, Matt, you know what this showcases really is. You know, we are in a very bad place in terms of trust and confidence. And the question here, you know, you were alluding to it, as was Catherine, that, you know, 6 months ago, 6 weeks ago, 6 days ago, it would have been, you know, Republicans loving the FBI and hating Democrats hating the FBI or something, and it all flips. But what this really comes down to is that the authorities in this country at every level and in every way, literally and figuratively, don't inspire trust and confidence. And we need to see how this plays out.
Peter, I mean, building on that, the FBI was in the middle of a lot of weird stuff over the last 6 years, a lot of it eroding people's sense of trust and confidence. Sure, there was a polarized approach and people wanted to have their confidence eroded, perhaps or arguably. But still, you have, the FBI greenlighting some pretty dodgy search warrants and other types of things based on, you know, partisanly nothing, very little information. Is there, to your satisfaction or to your knowledge, has there been anything like the FBI doing some searing moral inventory, to use a phrase that Nick knows well, about their own institutional...
I think it's fearless, Matt.
Fearless. It depends on the translation.
Yeah. Your moral inventory of me is searing. My moral inventory of myself is kind of fearless.
Has the FBI examined itself? I mean, I've seen, so I watched Merrick Garland's press conference, and in a way, it was kind of like dispassionate and impressive. And there was a, you know, the great I will release this, will you, Donald Trump, kind of a moment when it terms, comes the search warrant. But then he gets all defensive and high and mighty, like, who dares impugn the you know, the integrity of the FBI? It's like, I don't know, everybody. Has the FBI done the internal searching that it needs to restore credibility in these and other cases?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they'd have to get a warrant from a judge first, right? In order to do that.
No, you know, they actually don't. They're very good at just doing whatever they want.
They need to go on a, like, raid their own conscience.
Is this, a legal
here?
Search of your own conscience? Yeah.
I think, to build on Nick's point, it's not just that we are living in an era of declining trust. It's that we are living in an era of institutional failure, and in particular, bureaucratic failure. And we can point to the FBI, and we can also point to the CDC, which we're going to talk about later, and the FDA, and all of the sort of the bureaucratic institutions of public life have failed, notably in high-profile ways and repeatedly over the past several years. And what they have, and often they have failed while claiming that the reasons that they are doing the thing that they're doing are, it's oh, no, what we're doing is we're trying to uphold public faith in our in what we're in our institution, right? And so the CDC is like, no, we have to do everything by the book and do everything the dumbest and stupidest possible way in order to preserve and bolster faith in the public health establishment. And the FBI is constantly just like, we do things this way in order to build faith. They don't seem to have realized that there is no longer public faith in those institutions. And in some ways, or to the extent that they have internalized that idea, they have done so, like their reaction to it has been to say, oh no, we need to double down on the procedures and the sort of internal unwillingness to sort of think outside of our internal ways of thinking. In a way that is going to actually make public faith in these institutions even worse. Now, that said, that does not necessarily make this very specific instance in which the FBI raided Mar-a-Lago illegitimate. Just because an agency does a lot of dumb things, and just because people distrust them, in some cases rightly, does not make every single thing they do automatically moronic or illegitimate. At the same time, it means that when the FBI takes an action like this, which is inherently, even in an era of extremely high public trust in government, if stuff like this had happened in the 1950s, you still would have to imagine that there would be some level of you know, eyebrow raising, there, that this would, like, the public would be like, what is going on here? This is a big deal, right? This is not something that should be done lightly. And so what happens is, when you let trust and faith sort of die down, right, when you don't maintain them, and then you have to do something that requires a tough judgment call, as it surely did in this case, as Merrick Garland had to know, like, when he signed off on this, then what that means is you don't have the built-in credibility to make those calls, and, like, you're just going to sort of, you're just opening the floodgates for a sort of politicized culture war nonsense of the sort that we are seeing. And I think that's true, you know, that's true with the public health agencies as well. That's true with a lot of the bureaucracy right now, is that they have been running a trust deficit for so long that, like, their creditors are no longer willing to extend them any more credit.
One of the things, kind of building on something Peter was getting at, it would be ironic, you know, the Russiagate stuff was a total bust. And, you know, I do think that Democrats need to be held accountable, including flunkies in the federal government, for pushing the Russiagate line, the idea that Trump was somehow deeply in cahoots with Putin, and the Russian government.
There was that server that sent
came
that
a cropper,
sent the information.
You know, totally,
right?
Yeah.
With the Russian bank.
That's right. And, that was false. I mean, but it still lives on. It still persists. The one time a month that Rachel Maddow, you know, shows up impromptu on MSNBC, it's about that. But in this case, it looks like, you know, Trump clearly had stuff he shouldn't have had, and he didn't give it back what he was asked to. So
and
you get the
that,
worst of all possible worlds.
His lawyer told the FBI that actually we have given you all the stuff back.
Yeah.
But you get the worst of all possible worlds, where you have, you know, bad actors acting badly in a way that's it's impossible to disentangle. Matt, on that larger point about the FBI, I highly recommend people read Tim Weiner's Enemies, a History of the FBI. It really goes through Louis Free, who is the real villain of the book. I mean, who he paints as worse than J. Edgar Hoover. So this whole idea that, well, the FBI was a shit organization and then Hoover died and it got cleaned up is fundamentally false. And we're, you know, almost as far away from Hoover dying as him starting the thing. And it's not clear, you know, that he had the authorization to continue his position the way that he did. But we are decades after that, and the FBI has a lower reputation, rightly, for being honest, and forthright and constitutionally bound.
My question here, though, is I do think, in a weird way, Trump's defenders still have some wiggle room. And that is because this seems to me to be such a classic Hanlon's razor situation still, as with so many of Trump's failings.
What kind of razor?
Hanlon's razor. So this is the idea that you should always assume incompetence over conspiracy. You should always assume because there's certainly a narrative in which Donald Trump was keeping a hold of these nuclear documents or whatever they were, because he's going to sell them to the Russians in exchange for immortality or whatever.
Right. Those pee mattresses. They never showed up.
And this is what happens over and over with Trump, is that there is always a version of the story where he is playing, fifth dimensional chess toward very, very evil ends. But I think it is far more likely in this case and in so many other cases with Trump that he literally forgot that stuff was in there and doesn't employ a single competent person to have found out that that stuff was in there. And anyway, he kind of thought maybe this line of legal reasoning where he just blanket declassified anything that he walked out of the White House with, that he walked out of the Oval Office with. That's the justification. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, but it's stupid, not evil. Now, at some point,
stupid can be evil.
Let me finish my talking, gentlemen. At some point, your stupid becomes evil. And clearly, January 6th is an example of that. Clearly, he stupided his way to evil. But this isn't that. Whatever this is, he literally just couldn't bother to look to the bottom of the boxes, right?
Well, maybe. I don't think we know one way or the other. I don't think your theory is illegitimate, but let's say that your interpretation is correct. In one way, that's good for Trump, because arguably your interpretation looks less bad for him from a legal perspective. It suggests that probably this is the sort of thing where maybe the FBI was even totally in the right to do the raid, but that's it. They got the documents.
They needed to get them back.
And
you don't want those lying around, even if they weren't stolen on purpose.
On the other hand, your interpretation looks even worse for him from a political perspective, because it suggests total incompetence and lack of judgment. Now, that's not something that's a huge surprise from Donald Trump. At the same time, it reinforces that it hasn't changed and it is always and forever going to be a part of the Trump worldview ambit approach to everything, right? Is that he is never going to do anything competently or with thought or with care.
I think that the flip side of that is that if you were already anti-Trump, if you were already skeptical of Trump, you have been looking for really, you know, 7 years now for the smoking gun that's going to convince people who like him and trust him that he is not likable or trustable. And because every quarter for those 7 years, somebody has said like, aha, we found the thing. Look, now we have definitive proof that he is evil and anti-American. After a while, I mean, it's a very, very, very classic like MSM who cried wolf problem. And so now everyone's lost their sense of perspective. I don't know. It seems bad to have a bunch of, you know, secret nuclear documents in your house. On the other hand, I can't tell anymore what's good and what's bad and what's, you know, what we should just overlook. And I mean, all of us have lost our sense of perspective so spectacularly. And I, you know, my analysis here is impacted by that. Like,
are you looking forward to Joe Biden leading chants of lock him up?
When Joe Biden leaves office, like 1,000 years old and addled by God knows what, he's going to do stuff like this. And if he doesn't, it will only be because he is surrounded by competent people who prevent it. And when he does stuff like this, we will assume that he just made a mistake and that he didn't do, you know, that he wasn't part of some vast conspiracy. But it's because we haven't been exposed over and over to this message.
But Trump also doesn't admit that he lost the election. You know, I agree with you, Catherine. I don't see any of this as a conspiracy. I see it mostly as incompetence. And I'm also terrified at the idea that they haven't changed the nuclear codes that are somewhere floating around on like the stuck to the back of a menu.
Yeah, man. Like, we even change like our office alarm code sometime.
Yeah.
Like,
you know,
I'm hoping they're changing the nuclear codes a little more often.
If Trump got to set it, you know that it's Trump 2024. anyway, maybe with an exclamation point. So go ahead, Russia. You know, do your best. But that, you know, on some level, this is, that level of incompetency is an issue.
I agree completely. Strongly agree that it is an issue.
And I think of the four of us, I was probably the most favorable towards Trump when he was in office. And I wanted him to win. I wanted him to beat Biden. I think overall, he was not a terrible president. He's an incompetent, awful personality. And I do think after
president.
He refused to admit that he lost the election, that he's really kind of written himself out of any possible, legitimate right to hold office, whether he gets elected or not. But
we will absolutely not take the bait of judging whether the Trump presidency was good or bad, because that's too long of a conversation. However, I do want to get a reaction. Let's just throw it to Catherine. No, let's throw it to Peter. Rand Paul said a couple of days ago that suggested that maybe the FBI planted planted some evidence there, like they might have. Well, it's the FBI. It's what they do. Is that helpful?
You know, in the Muppet movie where the villain that he doesn't actually do a maniacal laugh because the script said maniacal laugh. And the villain, whoever the actor was, I forget his name. He was just like, well, he's just going to say maniacal laugh. And it's great. And I feel like here I want to just insert the deepest and most despairing sigh into the script, except I can't do it. I just want to say deepest and most despairing sigh. Deepest and most despairing sigh. That's it. That's my reaction.
I think we've given you license to use that from now on. Catherine, since you mentioned President Joseph Robinette Biden III, I would like to, before we make our mid-show pivot, that's what we call it here in the business, I wanted to repeat last week's award-winning segment, which we might name Read a Joe Biden Tweet and Make Catherine's Head Explode. Uh-huh. This one comes, prepare yourself. This one comes from just today, just this Monday morning, and it reads in full. Since the start of my presidency, my economic plan has helped create 9.5 million jobs, reach a 50-year record low unemployment rate, and achieve 0% inflation in July.
Where are you? Oh.
And this week, we're not done. And this week, I'll build on that progress by signing the Inflation Reduction Act into law. End tweet.
I didn't even see that this morning. So you caught me all unawares, which makes it even worse. Yeah. The annoying thing always about all these tweets is that like each little tiddly bit is technically true if you try hard and look at it by itself. Like, right this moment, this month, there is 0% inflation. That's right. That's not a lie. But like, oh my God, we're just banging our head against trees and we cannot see the forest. It's so infuriating. I hate it. And I hate you for making me hear these quotes.
Thank you. That's what we're here for. All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, ever feel like somebody's tracking you online, even when you think you're being discreet? Well, your suspicions are justified. That is, unless you're using IPVanish VPN. IPVanish is a service that helps you stay anonymous online. It's a marvelous tool to help you browse safely without exposing your private bits to third parties, such as advertisers, ISPs, or hackers. When you use IPVanish on your computer, tablet, phone, or other web-connected device, all of your data is encrypted. That means all your private details, passwords, communications, browsing history, physical location will be completely shielded, yet without sacrificing your speed. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online, period. Roundtable listeners who act right now will receive an incredible 70% off their yearly plan, all with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Just go to ipvanish.com/roundtable, use the promotional code roundtable, and take your privacy back right now. That's ipvanish.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, please email us your succinct yet challenging questions to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Joel Thompson, who writes, the U.S. federal government, since the beginning of the COVID pandemic, has monopsonized. I did it. COVID vaccines and therapies.
Hooray.
Yet I haven't heard any complaints from reasoners about this expansion of government into healthcare long after I think all of us would agree that the emergency should be over. And the government's performance has actually kind of sort of been okay in the last 8 months. What gives? There are now those who are using this experience as an argument that we should make all of healthcare single payer. How would you respond to those who say that and who say this proves single payer works? We should adopt it for everything. And then more broadly, while I believe our healthcare economic system is broken, I don't see a viable political path towards implementing more market-based reforms to introduce competition, incentivize innovation, bring down prices. Would it make sense for small L libertarians to basically give up on healthcare and make a deal with the devil, compromising on single-payer healthcare in exchange for liberalization of other areas of the economy that otherwise wouldn't see liberalization? Big question. Don't necessarily have to take all of it. But Peter, this is your area of expertise. Why don't you give us a start?
No, it would not make sense to give up on healthcare. Healthcare is so important to, you know, living and living well, that I think that allowing the government in the United States to just take over completely would be a bad trade. Now, it might mean in some cases that some people just decide to focus their efforts elsewhere because, in fact, it is really difficult to reform the United States healthcare system. At the same time, I continue to appreciate the fact that there are interesting ideas and big picture plans. My friend the occasional source, Michael Cannon, the health policy director from the Cato Institute, within the last few months just released a really interesting paper basically arguing that the carve out for employer sponsored health insurance acts effectively as a mandate, and that if you end it and replace it with very large health savings accounts, you could return a huge amount of money and choice to workers. It's a big picture, big vision. Nobody's running on it right now, but somebody needs to be out there putting forth these big ideas, giving politicians, giving bureaucrats, giving policymakers ammunition and ideas, and having them ready for when the time is right, because I think the current system is on the road to, if not wholesale collapse, then parts of it are going to start breaking in real ways over the next decade or two. And that is going to be a time when people are going to start looking for reforms, and having them out there is going to be a good idea. I would also just take issue with the idea that public health has done particularly well on vaccines over the past year or so. It is true that the vaccine rollout was not an absolute catastrophe in early 2021, but it could have gone faster. It could have the initial approval could have been done certainly weeks faster and probably months faster, depending on the type of testing that they would have allowed. And even this year, after, yes, many people, a good percentage of the United States has have been vaccinated, and most elderly people have been have gotten boosters. Even this year, we have had public health authorities delaying specific updated vaccines that would specifically target new variants, in part because of because they don't trust the public for these sort of dubious public health psychology reasons that have no real grounding in evidence. They're just like, well, you know, people are still kind of unsure about the vaccine that exists. We don't really want to scare them with a whole new one. That would be too complex for, you know, these simple-minded fools out there. This stuff is still happening, and I don't think that the public health bureaucracy has acquitted itself very well, even if you can say that it could have gone much, much worse. And so to me, that there's no case for saying, you know what, it's a lost cause. Let's just go the route of the NHS in the UK. But and like, even if you look at those other systems, go look at any of the big public health systems in Europe, in Canada, all of them have serious problems of either cost or access. And they need big reforms, and they have resisted them so far for the most part. But those reforms are going to have to come at some point. The United States being where it is and not having fully gone into the, you know, the federal government just manages and controls all healthcare financing is, I think, something is it's not a great system in a lot of ways. At the same time, that doesn't mean that we should just give up on it and only focus on, I don't know, criminal justice reform and marijuana.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about deals with the devil is that the devil usually gets the best of those deals. Like, I've read books. I've read mythology. Like, I'm aware that there is an occasional wily peasant who defeats the devil, but I don't know that the American libertarian movement is that wily peasant. And I just think, like, you know, that, as Peter says, I think it is a little bit of a misunderstanding, both on the part of the public and maybe on the part of the question writer, although he or she seems clear-eyed, but and beautiful. But the you know, the vaccine rollout and attendant kind of COVID care, like, I remember standing in line in the deli section of a Safeway hoping to get a vaccine. Like, that wasn't flawless rollout. Like, I think it's easy looking back to be like, hey, we actually did get these vaccines out and we got them to a lot of people. And that's true. But it was far from smooth. There were many, many places where price signals would have helped with production and distribution, and they weren't allowed to function. And in a single payer system, that would be more true.
Were they giving like a quarter of a pound of Capicola?
Honestly,
if you came in for a vaccine?
Like, you're joking, but people legit were there to like get their lunch meats. And then it was like, yeah. You know, I mean, you remember this, like, there would be a clerk from the pharmacy and they were supposed to allocate them based on need, but it was like informal. Yeah. So they'd be like, does anyone here have AIDS? You know what I mean? And it was like, what are we doing?
I do.
Like, it was not, whatever it was not an example of like an efficient bureaucracy at its best.
It was always the deli section.
What? Yeah, because that's how the Safeway is laid out. That's how they're laid out. They got the refrigeration back there.
It's, you know, I think it's dangerous always to kind of try and switch from an emergency situation to everyday life. So we should always think about that. I mean, the writer is correct that there was a monopsony put in place where the government was the purchaser of all of this stuff. But that's, you know, that was an emergency situation, which is fading. And I don't think we need to try to draw too many lessons or stick with the idea that, okay, what happens in an emergency is going to become the new normal. We should always be fighting against that no matter what. The other thing I would like to point out is that in healthcare and the delivery of healthcare, especially on a daily basis, there's all sorts of kind of market-driven innovations and reforms that are going on. Mark Cuban has his cost-plus drug company. There's a couple of other things like that coming out, which are really changing the way that healthcare gets delivered. And just things like telehealth and cheap telehealth and cheaper concierge care are happening. I suspect when healthcare reform changes, it's not going to be like a Berlin Wall moment. It's going to be more like the post office, just finally becoming irrelevant to most people's lives. We may still be paying a lot of taxes for things like Medicare and Medicaid, And I would love to see Medicare. I mean, Medicaid is a terrible program for the people in it. Medicare is a terrible program for the people who pay for it, but who are not in it. I would love to see both of those seriously reform. But I think, you know, it's much more likely that we will just grow past it and it will become this thing that, you know, thankfully we don't have to think about anymore, like the post office.
All right. Friday at a public event in Western New York, author and free speech hero Salman Rushdie was attacked on stage, stabbed repeatedly in the neck and face by a 24-year-old fanatic from New Jersey. Rushdie is off a ventilator now, though he reportedly might lose an eye. His liver has been damaged. The nerves in his arm were severed. This comes 33 years after the initial fatwa was issued against Rushdie by the Ayatollah Khomeini in response to his novelist's satanic verses. Over the years, there have been serial and frequently lethal attacks on various translators and publishers. Barry Weiss over the weekend had a piece at Common Sense that just sort of like listed everyone who's died and been attacked based on this. And you forget that the body count is pretty horribly high. Nick, we've been writing and talking about this at Reason since 1989, literally, and been a major theme. Can you just sort of like walk us through our feelings and emotions at this moment with someone who, after the fatwa was issued against him, has been just a champion, really, of free speech? He didn't become a reactionary. He just became a champion.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, fantastic. And if you can go back at Reason and search our archives and things like that, I think, you know, this it exemplifies the case for free speech and for free discourse. You know, and obviously, you know, Rushdie was accused of blasphemy, which is a pre-modern category of law, and it has no place in you know public discourse in a contemporary world, in a liberal world, certainly not in the United States. And one of the things that is worth thinking about, I think, or there are two things. One is to look at the people who were weak defenders of free speech when this happened. And there were many people, particularly in the UK and in the US, who were like, well, what do you expect or whatever? And if your first response to somebody being, you know, sentenced to death for writing a fucking novel is like, well, you know, it, you know, what do you, you know, of course, you know, like there's something wrong with you and you really have to reevaluate your commitment to living in an open society, in a decent society, in a tolerant society. And the other thing I think that we need to do is to look at the past, you know, 30 plus years of equating speech with violence, which is not to say speech obviously has effects on people. And, you know, fighting words and imminent threats are actionable speech because it's not simply speech. But, you know, and literature moves people to tears, it moves them to anger, it moves them to suicide, but it's not violence. And we need to, you know, because right now in America, we have been building up, or some people have been building up a case of how certain thoughts, when they are uttered or put into speech you know, written down, are violent and evil and offensive and must thus be regulated. That is wrong. And that's a fundamentally bad equation of, you know, of thought and speech. And that is the that's the thing that we need to be focused on right now, I think.
Peter, there's brought up Barry Weiss, but previously, she and other people who are been kind of vigorous, you know, signers of the Harper's letter from back a couple of years ago, right, in favor of free speech, as was Salman Rushdie, as was a lot of people who are adjacent or have contributed to Reason over the years, sort of point or draw a direct line between the noticeable increase in the idea that words are violence and this attack. Do you think that that line has been drawn? Like, did it increase the likelihood of this thing happening?
I don't know if it increased the likelihood, but it is notable that the attacker was 24 years old, which is to say that the attacker was younger than the fatwa. So this is a person who grew up not, who didn't sort of come of age with the fatwa, but who grew up in a world where it had always existed. And, you know, it's always, I think it's usually, maybe not always, but usually a mistake to pin single acts of violence on sort of cultures of discourse. At the same time, so I don't want to say that this was that this was a direct result. It's of the campus speech culture or anything like that. That I think is sort of silly and stretching it. At the same time, this does emphasize the and you sort of reiterate why free speech defenders have to be incredibly vigilant all the time about everything and can never sort of say, well, you know what? I think in this case, maybe we'll just let those words, we'll treat those words as violence, but just not any others. The takeaway here is that you can't give an inch, that you must always, always demarcate the line between speech and violence because they are never the same thing. Yes, there are words that are, like Nick said, actionable because they are direct, imminent calls to violence. But an idea and that gives offense, a word that people are bothered by, that it offends their sensibilities, their religion, it makes them feel something that they don't like. I'm sorry, that's language, folks. That is expression. And in a world where we have a free exchange of ideas, that always has to be allowed, and it always has to be understood to not be violence. And you can't give the people on the other side anything here. You can't give in at all to the idea that, you know what, sometimes offense, it really is so bad that we just got to say no. We're not going to do that because people think it's akin to a violent act, and it just sort of makes me, I found it very upsetting, in part just because I have a somewhat tenuous personal connection here. My wife was on the same stage a few days earlier that week at the same institution, and it is a reminder that that writing and expressing yourself is. Can be a dangerous act, often has been, but it shouldn't be. And the thing that stuck out to me from this was if I read the coverage correctly, Rushdie was there for a panel. The topic of it was that about how the United States is a refuge for writers who are escaping violence and who have been persecuted elsewhere. And it's very upsetting to see someone come to the United States and be, you know, and be on a panel where he's speaking openly out in public, right? And just wants to sort of live his life and be able to express his ideas, and to see him attacked and face violent consequences for that. It's incredibly disturbing.
Catherine, you just published a very successful Banned Books edition of Reason Print Magazine, which still is printed, Catherine. I have boxes of them here. Yeah. And you threw...
The FBI is coming to check those out.
you also threw an event, a party at Reason HQ, wondering if you have any reflections on kind of, blasphemy as an idea, both as like a direct idea, people who really feel blasphemed, and also like the transference of the concept of blasphemy into contemporary times, maybe not explicitly religious, but the feeling that people feel like they've been blasphemed seems to be around us.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, in the Banned Books issue, we had a bunch of little book reviews of books that had been challenged or banned in various ways. And Reason's own Liz Wolf wrote up Salman Rushdie's work. And I actually, you know, when we were deciding what to include, unfortunately, we had a lot of choices. We had many, many options. We could have filled four issues, you know, with the very top tier of books that are routinely challenged or banned. And I wasn't sure we should include Salman Rushdie. It actually felt a little bit to me like, oh, it's old news. I'm glad that
so it's Captain Underpants. Satanic Verses.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't Captain Underpants, actually. It was Ook and Gluk, Kung Fu Caveman from the future. So, get it straight, Nick. But I'm glad that we did include it. Both because he is a long time warrior for free speech and a long time victim of would be banners, and so I think that's worth, you know, it's always worth giving the kudos. I think that there is this sense that, especially in the U.S., as we become, a ever less religious people, that we still do want to have this category of speech that is extra bonus wrong and therefore prohibitable. And Suderman is right that the only thing that we can do, the only choice that we have is to hold the line and to say violence is violence, speech is speech. And it really doesn't matter how bad the speech makes you feel. It really doesn't. And once it crosses over into violence, as it did in this case, then we bring down the hammer.
Matt, could you talk about your writing about the Charlie Hebdo massacre in France? Because that's more recent, obviously, but it has many of the same themes here. And I thought your discussion of that and what was at stake was, you know, particularly kind of inspiring.
Thank you for that. The lesson of the Charlie Hebdo massacre is a grim and sad one, and one that's absolutely underscored by Rushdie getting attacked, which is that recall that a lot of this emanated, the Charlie Hebdo aspect of it emanated because of the satirical French anti-clerical paper that's been around since 1970s, which loved to blaspheme and has had a lot of beloved French cartoonists and illustrators and comics. After there was a Danish cartoon crisis in the mid aughts, where the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten posted a bunch of cartoons of Muhammad. This was, you know, it actually happened and no one really cared, but then it was circulated months later by opportunistic jihadis and Muslim extremists,
who added things that not appeared in the newspaper in their portfolio, yes, when they went around Europe and the Middle East to stoke outrage.
So they stoked outrage. There's all kinds of attacks on embassies and consulates, riots. Charlie Hebdo was happy to reprint that cartoon, but other people were not. And this was the moment that it could have been that the entire liberal tradition and countries that have in which liberalism has thrived and people who work in the free speech business could have at that moment shown an act of not just solidarity, but and also like just news judgment. Like if you're going to write about a cartoon and you're not going to show the cartoon, how are people going to realize how stupid this whole thing is? And that's what largely happened, is that with very, very few exceptions in the UK and the US and in Canada, those exceptions included Reason online. No one reprinted the cartoons. They were afraid of giving offense. They said, in fact, I think many of them were afraid of being attacked. This was definitely the case at the Los Angeles Times, where I worked at the time, and I made a very, you know, spirited argument to have them reprinted, at least in the opinion section, because I knew the news section would be gutless, headed by Dean Baquet back in the day. And ultimately, what won the day was like, you know, we don't want our receptionist to be blown up by a bomb. And I get that. That's, you know, that's a responsible decision. But the problem is everybody else came with the same response to that. You know, the Western Standard in Canada was one of the only print exceptions in
Harper's.
North America.
Awesome.
Harper's. And so what happens in that moment? That means that the people who do, the very few people who have the bravery to just show a thing, all have bigger targets on their back, because you didn't choose. You were afraid to risk having a target on their back. And so Charlie Hebdo was always going to be the paper who not only did that, but they would have covers of Muhammad or a Muslim making out with people. They just didn't give a rip about this. And because of that, they had the biggest target on their back. You know, Penn Jillette, who Nick did a recent great interview with, and the guys at South Park, who we've been friendly with over the years, they have both said, and they at least have the integrity to say this out loud, they have both said, yeah, this is the one subject we can't really do. Whether it's because, you know, their own kind of corporate arrangements, or they're just afraid, and they're willing to say that they are afraid of getting attacked. It's awful. So Charlie Hebdo had the biggest target on its back, and as a result, those people are dead. Salman Rushdie has had the biggest target on his back, and as a result, he probably will lose an eye. So yeah, we should reflect on the fact that he has lived bravely for a really, really long time. At, you know, hopping in any cab in New York City where he lives, the chances of having a Pakistani Muslim driving you is pretty high. Pretty high. He's been riding cabs for a while. It's really awful. It's dispiriting. It should be a prod for everyone to live even one zillionth as bravely as Salman Rushdie has. And again, he's done it without becoming a complete a-hole. I would turn into a reactionary zealot and want to like behead people if it's what had happened to him had happened to me. And he's maintained, decency and humor throughout this, which is just astonishing. So, yeah, this is a really distressing and awful day. And I can't believe that, you know, reportedly he's telling jokes to people in the hospital after such a horrible thing. So the rest of us should be better. And we're not. And that's too bad. All right. Sorry to bum everyone out. Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural sphere. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
Oh, well, I'm reading a book about converting to Islam.
Called Yusuf Islam was right.
That's right. Yeah. From Cat Stevens to Yusuf Islam. Now, I read a very good book by a guy named Nick Gray. It's called The 2-Hour Cocktail Party, How to Build Big Relationships at Small Gatherings. And he actually hosted an event in New York last week. That is, it's a great kind of way. The starting point of this is that once you hit your 30s and beyond, it's really hard to actually make new friends or meet new people outside of very specific work situations. And this is a great book that kind of, I think in an earlier America, we would have learned how to do this, or we would have been taught how to do this, or we would have experienced this type of thing from our parents or from older people that don't do it anymore. And the 2-hour cocktail party, he put together a great party of about 20 or 25 people who were interesting, with the exception of me, obviously, and really great to know. I'm dazzled by it. And this book, The 2-Hour Cocktail Party, lays out how to do that and just makes it easier and exciting to have small parties and gatherings and connect with the people around you in new and fascinating ways. So
does he recommend any specific cocktails?
No, he doesn't, Peter. And as a matter of fact, I want to point out, because this whole thing is about de-intimidating stuff, so there's no fucking bullshit about how you have to spend 8 months curing your tomato strips and then squeezing them into bitters or anything. It's like, buy cheap wine and beer and seltzer water. The food doesn't matter. You're not preparing dinner. You're not even necessarily having a good nosh. It's mostly people are dying to get together and talk and meet in a not a super intimate setting, but not a big kind of industrial rave either. So The 2-Hour Cocktail Party, very good, by Nick Gray.
Ooh, call on me next.
I
went to a 2-hour cocktail party that was based entirely on drying tomato strips and then squeezing them into, and it was amazing. So I think that there are many ways to gather people together. Suderman and I, along with a friend of mine from college, went to Chantal Tseng's Literary Cocktails, which was at the Gibson here in DC. It was cocktails based on Andy Weir's Project Hail Mary, a book I have recommended on this podcast before. It was a couple of hours of extremely fancy cocktails that also brought people together for interesting conversation. And I think that you do not have to talk smack about the fancy cocktails, Nick, in order to get the result that you are hyping up here. It was really cool. It was basically like some quotes from the book, and all the cocktails had like bubbles in them because, you know, the book takes place in the stars, my friends. This is the kind of thing.
The stars are carbonated?
Yeah, you know, that's the famous line about like the first bottle of champagne where he like opens it and drinks it and he says,
"Come
quickly.
It's full of stars.
I am tasting stars." Yeah. So anyway, all of that is by way of saying this was, of course, done by professionals and extremely competently. But if you are having 2-hour cocktail parties, they could have a cute theme like this and people might enjoy it. Also, you should read Superman. Project Hail Mary, because it's really, really good. I know I've said that before, but I'm going to say it again. Great book. First Contact, global warming allegory that Andy Weir denies is a global warming allegory.
Does it blaspheme the Virgin Mary, Mother of God?
There is almost no blasphemy in it, yeah.
Only in the title.
Oh, I'm out. Yeah.
It's the Feast of the Assumption, Nick. I want you to behave
better. Oh, my God, Peter. Matt, you are becoming Catholic, aren't you? You're a Marian devotee.
Oh my God, Matt. I'm dragging my feet slowly. Peter, do you want to make it a cocktail trifecta and prove everyone right?
Well, I mean, I attended the Project Hail Mary literary events at the Gibson, and it was great because I hadn't been there in a long time, and I hadn't had Chantel's literary cocktails since before the pandemic. She's wonderful, but I actually want to talk about the new Beyoncé album, Renaissance.
Peter Zuberman, man of the people, woman of the people. Really?
So look, it's the
one that's a challenge to free expression.
We're gonna get there. So the thing is, this is a great record. It is just like it's a fun summer album that's full of like super intricate bangers. Love the production on this, right? There's so much sort of interest, so many interesting kind of sonic layers. It's just full of exquisite sounds and yet also in no way pretentious. It doesn't feel like it's difficult or inaccessible. This is an album that like comes to you and is like, hey, have fun. And I am frustrated somewhat because it has gotten good reviews and some, you know, good press, but it has, I think, been overshadowed to some extent by complaints about a single word, I guess one word that appears twice in the original version of the album, that some people said caused offense, and that word is spaz. Beyoncé is the second artist this summer who used the word spaz in a song. In this case, in the lyrics, spazzin' on that ass, spaz on that ass. Yes, and that's exactly how she says it, too.
That is the greatest dramatic hip-hop reading since Bill Bennett did Cop Killer.
Yep, so Lizzo also recorded a song with the word spaz and then had to re-record it like Beyoncé because there were groups...
They didn't have to. They spazzed out.
Chose to, that is correct. Re-recorded, both of them ended up re-recording lines on their albums because there were complaints that the word spaz is ableist, that it's a slur against people who have cerebral palsy. Now, obviously, since we did talk about like Salman Rushdie earlier, this is not, you know, a problem on the level of like somebody came and stabbed. There's no violence here. There's nothing like that. It's not the same sort of level of social problem. And I don't mean to suggest that there's sort of a comparison between the two at all. It just sort of happened that they ended up on the same podcast. At the same time, this discourse is quite frustrating and disappointing, in that it's, like, that word is obviously not intended or by almost anyone understood to be a slur in this context. And it's just like a willfully, I think, obtuse reading of the language. And like, it is, these are, when you're complaining about words like this, you're going out of your way to look for offense and to try to find it, even when it's not really there. And I think that is a bad way to engage with pop culture and with art. It takes away from what I think is actually a pretty great album. And we've seen a bunch of these sort of big releases from hip hop stars over the last year or two, kind of since the pandemic. Drake, I think, has had two albums. There's been Kanye West, a new Kendrick Lamar album. And I think that like, if you're looking at the top tier megastar albums that have come out over the past year and a half or so, this is probably the best of the bunch, just on a kind of like a musical fun level. It's so intense and so direct and so smart, yet with like again without feeling like this is intentionally going to be difficult or sort of inward looking. No, this is an album that invites people in and is just a great listen. And yet what people want to talk about is the use of a word that was not intended as a slur, was not understood to be a slur, and that no one in their right mind would take as a slur. And that's where that leaves us. And I just think that that's like it's a really dispiriting way to approach pop culture and appreciation of art.
Can I point out the Dave Pilkey book about the cavemen that Catherine mentioned? That was called out by like a single person. The outrage about that. Dave Pilkey's Captain Underpants books are routinely among the most challenged books in school libraries because there's a lot of snot and underwear jokes and, you know, bodily fluids.
Which definitely 8-year-olds have never encountered before.
Of course not, no. And, you know, but that book, the caveman book, was called out by a single guy. And, you know, that it's a problem, you know, that that's happening. And then more importantly, I think the way people respond to it, that's the issue ultimately, because everybody will say, you know, the guy who stabbed Salman Rushdie is a psychotic. But then it's like, how do we deal with that as a culture? And we should be more, you know, robust in defending expression, including the word spaz.
The mention of Captain Underpants is causing me to do a
also a assumed body and soul into heaven, Matt Welch, by the way. I have that on good authority. The Pope's going to be issuing an encyclical about that pretty soon.
I'm doing a game time decision here to change my recommendation to a comic book store. Believe it or not, it's me, not Suderman, recommending that we visited over this weekend. It's wonderful. It's called Hey Kids Comics. It's in Greenpoint. It's run by our friend Jason Mojica. He used to work at Vice News and done a bunch of stuff besides. He hosted a thing for me and Nick like 10, 15 years ago in D.C. That was really fun. It is a tiny little comic book store aimed at kids between the ages of 6 and 10. And I have one of those. And she visited it and just loved it. Full of Captain Underpants and all that kind of stuff and Cat Kid. But also like the graphic novels of what's her name? Telgemeier. What's her
Raina.
Name, Catherine? The Raina Telgemeier. Meyer, the ghost and all that kind of stuff, sisters. Not only is it a nice little place, like 250 square feet, a tiny place, but they also do like a comic club, a subscription situation where you can pay $20 a month and you get a new graphic novel for kids, or a graphic book of some sort, comic book for kids. Plus, they have like a monthly comic newsletter, including kids drawn comics that are in there. And hopefully my 7-year-old will be contributing
God.
To that.
You're putting your thumb on the scale by touting it, aren't you, Matt Welch?
Well, I mean, she's got to deliver. So that's, you know, given track records of my family, we can deadlines are not always the things that are met most quickly. But anyways, it was such a nice store. And there's stuff for the adults there as well. You'll end up spending more money than you bargained for. Like really just interesting things. And Jason is a sweetheart of a guy, loves to explain things. And it's great. You can go to heykidscomics.net to see what he has and they have on offer. And if you're in the greater New York area, it's just a nice place to visit. And it's in the middle of Greenpoint, which is a great old Polish neighborhood with a lot of bustling stuff going on. So go check that out, please. And then next week I will talk about, you know, the documentaries that everyone has seen before. But I finally watched this past week. Okay, that's all the mumbling we have time for this week. Thank you for listening to the Reason Roundtable podcast. You should listen to all of our podcasts, which you can find at reason.com/podcasts, including the terrific Reason Rundown with Peter Suderman. Mm. That last episode was a humdinger.
Thanks for being on the show, Matt.
You know, it got me off my Ambien prescription for good.
Nick Gillespie, who's absolutely slaying dragons with the recent interview with Nick Gillespie, is having a remarkable run of interviews over there. And then the Soho Forum series with Gene Epstein. All that stuff, great. We're trying to do more of it. And if you like what we do as an organization, please go to reason.com/donate. Give us the monies. We can do more of it if you like it, okay? All right.
If you give us enough, we'll do even less.
Next week, it'll be nothing but Joe Biden tweets and Catherine grimace sounds. Okay, we'll see you then. Bye.